Under the command of Napoleon III and Victor Emmanuel, the Franco-Piedmontese army won a series of rapid victories, destroying the Austrian forces under the command of Emperor Franz Joseph at the Battle of Solferino on the 24th of June, the last major battle in history in which all the armies were under the personal command of their monarchs. By this time, Napoleon was afraid that the German states might take up arms in support of Austria. Therefore, without telling the Piedmontese, he signed an armistice with the Austrians at Villa Franca, by which most of Lombardy, including its capital, Milan, was transferred to the French, who immediately gave it to Piedmont, as agreed by Napoleon and Cavour at Plombières. The Villa Franca deal restored the monarchs of the central Italian states, Parma, Modena, and Tuscany, who had been unseated by the popular revolt that broke out at the beginning of the war, a deal that enraged the Piedmontese, though it pleased the Russians, who had deep concerns about the way the Italian movement was taking a revolutionary turn. The Piedmontese army proceeded to annex the central states. Savoy and Nice were transferred to France, its agreed reward for helping the Italian cause. Their cession was opposed by the revolutionary general Giuseppe Garibaldi, a hero of the war against the Austrians, who had been born in Nice. In the spring of 1860, he led his 1,000 red shirts on an expedition to conquer Sicily and Naples and unite them with the rest of Italy under Piedmont's leadership. The revolutionary turn taken by the Garibaldians placed a severe strain on the Tsar's relations with Napoleon. It brought home to him that giving his support to the French Emperor's policies could have dangerous consequences. There was nothing to prevent the tide of nationalism spreading into Habsburg lands and from there into Poland and other Russian territories. In October 1860, Russia broke off relations with Piedmont as a protest against its annexation of Naples. Gorchakov condemned Piedmont for promoting revolution, pledged to oppose the territorial changes taking place in Italy unless they were approved by a new international congress, and gave his cautious backing to the Austrians in Italy. There was no chance of the Russians actually fighting to keep the Habsburgs in Venetia, the only part of the peninsula, along with the papal city of Rome, that had not yet been unified under the control of the First Italian Parliament, which met at Turin in 1861. When Victor Emmanuel took the title of King of Italy in March 1861, the Russians and the Austrians agreed together to refuse him recognition, despite pressure from the British and the French. When the British asked Gorchakov to use his influence on the Prussians to recognise the king, the Russian foreign minister refused. The Holy Alliance was not quite dead, it seemed. Justifying his refusal to cooperate with Britain's plans for Italy, Gorchakov maintained that Austria and Turkey might be undermined by revolutionary movements if the powers left unchecked the nationalist uprisings started by the Piedmontese. With tongue in cheek, perhaps, given how the British had justified their actions in the Crimean War, Gorchakov informed Lord Napier, the British ambassador in St. Petersburg, "We have two cardinal objects, the preservation of Turkey and the preservation of Austria." The Polish uprising of 1863 was the final breaking point for Russia's policy of friendship towards France. Inspired by Garibaldi, Polish students began demonstrations in 1861, prompting General Lambert, the Tsar's viceroy, to impose martial law. The Polish leaders gathered secretly, some supporting the idea of a popular democratic revolution uniting peasants and workers, others, led by Czartoryski, more conservative, seeking to establish a national movement led by nobles and intellectuals. The uprising began as a spontaneous protest against conscription into the Russian army. Small groups of insurgents fought the mighty Russian army from guerrilla strongholds, mainly in the forests of Lithuania, Poland, Belarus, and Western Catholic Ukraine. Some of them had fought against the Russians during the Crimean War, including many of the Zouaves of Death, organised by François Rochebrune, who had served as an officer with the French Zouaves in the Crimea and had taken part in the Anglo-French expedition to China in the Second Opium War of 1857, before settling in Krakow in Austrian Poland, where he had set up a fencing school. Dressed in a black uniform with a white cross and a red fez, and many of them armed with Minier rifles from the Crimean War, the Polish Zouaves swore to die rather than surrender to the Russians. A clandestine revolutionary government was established in Warsaw. It declared all sons of Poland free and equal citizens, gave the peasants ownership of land, and appealed for help to the nations of Europe. Pope Pius IX ordered special prayers for the victory of Catholic Poland against Orthodox Russia, and was active in arousing sympathy for the Polish rebels in Italy and France. Napoleon wanted to land troops in the Baltic to support the Poles, but was held back by the British, who feared a renewal of the Crimean War. In the end, the competing French invasion of Mexico prevented troops from being sent. The diplomatic intervention of the Western powers on behalf of Poland angered the Russians, who felt betrayed by the French in particular. It made the Russians even more determined to crush the Polish insurrectionaries. The Russian army burned whole towns and villages, tens of thousands of Polish men and women were exiled to Siberia, and hundreds of insurgents were publicly hanged. Alarmed by the consequences of their pro-French policies, the Russians moved away from France in the wake of the Polish uprising and returned to their old alliance with Prussia, another ruler of annexed Polish territory and the only power that had supported them against the Poles. A military convention had allowed the Russians to transport troops on Prussian trains. To Alexander, who had always had his doubts about the liberal French, Prussia seemed a more reliably conservative ally and a counterbalance to the growing influence and power of the French on the continent. The Russians gave considerable backing to Otto von Bismarck, the Prussian Prime Minister, whose conservatism had been noted by the Tsar during his period as ambassador in St. Petersburg between 1859 and 1862. Bismarck himself placed a high priority on his good relations with Russia, which consistently supported Prussia in its wars against Denmark in 1864, Austria in 1866, and France in 1870. With the defeat of France and the support of a grateful Germany, united by Bismarck, in 1871, Russia finally succeeded in getting the removal of Article 11 of the Paris Treaty, allowing it to recommission its Black Sea Fleet. Events moved so rapidly in the 15 years since the treaty that the international landscape was almost unrecognizable, with Napoleon III in exile in England following his removal by the forces of the Third Republic, Austria and France reduced in power and prestige, and the establishment of Germany and Italy as new states, the issues and passions of the Crimean War rapidly receded into the distance. Russia did not lose a lot in terms of territory, but it was humbled by the Paris Treaty. Apart from the loss of its Black Sea Fleet and Bessarabia, it lost prestige in the Balkans and forfeited the gains that it had made in the Eastern Question since the 18th century. Russia did not recover the dominant position it had held in Europe until after 1945. The demilitarization of the Black Sea was a major strategic blow to Russia, which was no longer able to protect its vulnerable southern coastal frontier against the British or any other fleet, should the Sultan call on them in the event of war. The destruction of the Russian Black Sea Fleet, Sevastopol, and other naval docks was a humiliation. No compulsory disarmament had ever been imposed on a great power previously. Not even France had been disarmed after the Napoleonic Wars. The way Russia had been treated was unprecedented for the Concert of Europe, which was supposed to honour the principle that no great power should be humbled by others. But the Allies did not really think that they were dealing with a European power in Russia. They regarded Russia as a semi-Asiatic state. During the negotiations at the Paris Congress, Walewski had asked the British delegates whether it would not be too humiliating for the Russians if the Western powers installed consuls in their Black Sea ports to police the demobilization. Cowley insisted that it would not, pointing out that a similar condition had been imposed on China by the Treaty of Nanking after the First Opium War. In Russia itself, the Crimean defeat discredited the armed services and highlighted the need to modernize the country's defenses, not just in the strictly military sense, but also through the building of railways, industrialization, sound finances, and so on. The Ministry of War lost the favoured position it had held in the government system of Nicholas I and became overshadowed by the Ministries of Finance and the Interior, although unavoidably it continued to receive the lion's share of state expenditure. The image many Russians had built up of their country, the biggest, richest, and most powerful in the world, had suddenly been shattered. Russia's backwardness had been exposed. Calls for reform were heard from every quarter of society. Everything was open to question. The Crimean disaster had exposed the shortcomings of every institution in Russia, not just the corruption and incompetence of the military command, the technological backwardness of the army and the navy, or the inadequate roads and lack of railways that accounted for the chronic problems of supply, but the poor condition and illiteracy of the serfs who had made up the armed forces, the inability of the serf economy to sustain a state at war against the industrial powers, and the failures of autocracy itself. Critics focused on Nicholas I, whose arrogant and willful policies had led the country to ruin and sacrificed so many lives. "Public opinion is now very scornful of the memory of Nicholas," Chucheva noted in her diary. "With every new setback, there are bitter reproaches against his name. They accuse him of pursuing a purely personal policy, which, for the sake of his own pride and glory, renounced the historical traditions of Russia, failed our brothers, the Orthodox Slavs, and turned the Tsar into the gendarme of Europe, when he could and should have brought new life to the East and the Church." Even in the governing elite, the bankruptcy of the Nikolaevan system was recognized. "My God, so many victims," wrote the Tsarist censor Alexander Nikitchenko in his diary, "all at the behest of a mad will, drunk with absolute power and arrogance. We have been waging war not for 2 years, but for 30, maintaining an army of 1 million men and constantly threatening Europe. What was the point of it all? What profit, what glory has Russia reaped from this?" A few years earlier, Nikitchenko reflected, the Pan-Slav nationalists in Moscow had been preaching that the West was in decline, that a new Slavic civilization under Russian leadership would take its place. "And now Europe has proved to us in our ignorance and apathy, our arrogant contempt for her civilization, just how decayed Russia really is. Oh, what wretches we are!" One of the voices calling for reform belonged to Tolstoy, whose Sevastopol sketches had catapulted him to literary fame. Tolstoy's experience of the Crimean War shaped his ideas on life and literature. He had witnessed at first hand the incompetence and corruption of many officers, and their often brutal treatment of the ordinary soldiers and sailors whose courage and resilience had inspired him. It was in his diary of the campaign that he first developed his ideas for radical reform and vowed to fight injustice with his pen. On his way from Odessa to Sevastopol in November 1854, he was told by the pilot of his boat about the transport of the soldiers, "how a soldier lay down in the pouring rain on the wet bottom of the boat and fell asleep, how an officer beat a soldier for scratching himself, and how a soldier shot himself during the crossing for fear of having overstayed his leave by 2 days, and how he was thrown overboard without burial." The contrast with the way he thought the ordinary soldier was treated in the Western armies brought home the need for change. "I spent a couple of hours chatting with French and English wounded," Tolstoy noted in his diary at Esky Orda, near Simferopol, the same month. "Every soldier is proud of his position and respects himself, for he feels himself to be an effective spring in the army machine. Good weapons and the skill to use them, youth and general ideas about politics and the arts give them an awareness of their own worth. With us, stupid foot and arms drills, useless weapons, oppression, age, lack of education and bad food and keep destroy the men's last spark of pride and even give them too high an opinion of the enemy. It is doubtful whether many private soldiers in the French or British army had strong ideas about the arts. As with so much Russian admiration of the West, there was a good deal of naivety in Tolstoy's assessment, but such ideals gave energy to his reformist zeal. On the death of Nicholas I, Tolstoy drafted a plan for the reform of the army and presented it to Count Ostensakon, the commander of the Sevastopol garrison, in the hope that he would forward it to the new Tsar Alexander, who was said to favour more humane policies. On the strength of this rumour, Tolstoy opened his proposal with a bold declaration of principle that was true in part, yet hardly a fair comment on the brave defenders of Sevastopol. "My conscience and sense of justice forbid me to keep silent in the face of the evil being openly perpetrated before me, causing the deaths of millions and sapping our strength and undermining our country's honour. We have no army. We have a horde of slaves cowed by discipline, ordered about by thieves and slave traders. This horde is not an army because it possesses neither any real loyalty to faith, Tsar and fatherland, words that have been so much misused, nor valour, nor military dignity. All it possesses are, on the one hand, passive patience and repressed discontent, and on the other, cruelty, servitude, and corruption." Tolstoy strongly condemned the harsh treatment of the serf soldiers. In an early version of his proposals, he even went so far as to maintain that, in every beaten soldier, there was a buried feeling of revenge, that was too suppressed to appear yet as a real force, but was waiting to erupt. And, oh Lord, what horrors lie in wait for our society if that should occur. He later cut this inflammatory sentence on the calculation that it would scotch his reform ideas in government circles. Tolstoy called for an end to corporal punishment in the army, blaming Russia's poor performance in the Crimean War on the brutalization of the troops. He advanced plans for the reform of the artillery, which had been shown to be so ineffective against the Minier rifles. Putting forward his ideas about how to improve the command, he delivered a devastating critique of the officers in the Crimea, denouncing them as cruel and corrupt, concerned mainly with the minutiae of the soldiers' uniforms and drill, and serving in the army only because they were unfit for anything else. But once again he cut out a fiery passage in which he had claimed that the senior commanders were courtiers, selected because the Tsar liked them and not for their competence, on the grounds that it would lessen his chances of getting a hearing for his plans. It was already being rumoured that he was the anonymous author of a satirical army song in which the defeats in the Crimea were blamed on the incompetence of the officers with the biggest epaulettes. The ballad circulated widely in the army and society, earning Tolstoy, as its suspected author, a reprimand from the Grand Duke Mikhail Nikolaevich, the Tsar's brother, who accused the verses of destroying the morale of the soldiers. Though Tolstoy's authorship was never established, he was denied promotion beyond second lieutenant, a rank he had obtained before his arrival in Sevastopol. Tolstoy's experience in the Crimean War had led him to question more than just the military system. The poet Afanasy Fet, who first met Tolstoy in Turgenev's St. Petersburg apartment in the winter of 1855, was struck by the young man's automatic opposition to all generally accepted opinions. Living side by side with the ordinary soldiers in the Crimea had opened Tolstoy's eyes to the simple virtues of the peasantry. It had set him on a restless search for a new truth, for a way to live morally as a Russian nobleman and landowner, given the injustices of serfdom. He had touched on these matters before. In A Landowner's Mourning, 1852, he wrote about a landowner, for which read Tolstoy, who seeks a life of happiness and justice in the country, and learns that it can only be found in constant labour for the good of others less happy than himself. At around the same time, he had proposed to reduce the dues of the serfs on his estate at Yasnaya Polyana, but the serfs were suspicious of his intentions. They were not accustomed to such benevolence, and had turned his offer down. But it was only in the Crimea that Tolstoy began to feel a close attachment to the serfs in uniform, those simple and kind men whose goodness is apparent during a real war. He was disgusted with his former life, the gambling, the whoring, the excessive feasting and drinking, the embarrassment of riches, and the lack of any real work or purpose in his life. And after the war, he threw himself into the task of living with the peasants in a life of truth with new determination. By the time of Tolstoy's return, there was a new reformist spirit in the air. Among the more liberal and enlightened noblemen, it was generally accepted that the time had come to liberate their serfs. In the words of Sergei Volkonsky, the famous Decembrist and one of Tolstoy's distant relatives, who was released from his Siberian exile in 1856, the abolition of serfdom was the least the state could do to recognize the sacrifice the peasantry has made in the last two wars. It is time to recognize that the Russian peasant is a citizen as well. The peasant soldiers who had fought in the Crimea had been led to expect their freedom. In the spring of 1854, thousands of peasants had turned up at the recruiting stations after hearing rumours that freedom had been promised by the Tsar to any serf who volunteered for the army or navy, and there had been clashes with the soldiers and police when they were turned away. Expectations of emancipation mounted after the Crimean War. In the first 6 years of Alexander's reign, there were 500 peasant uprisings and strikes against the gentry on the land. The new Tsar believed that the liberation of the serfs was a necessary measure to prevent a revolution. "It is better to abolish serfdom from above than to wait for the time when it begins to abolish itself from below," he told a group of Moscow noblemen in 1856. The defeat in the Crimean War had persuaded Alexander that Russia could not compete with the Western powers until it swept aside its old serf economy and modernized itself. The gentry had very little idea how to make a profit from their estates. Most of them knew next to nothing about agriculture or accounting, yet they went on spending in the same old lavish way as they had always done, mounting up enormous debts. By 1859, one-third of the estates and two-thirds of the serfs owned by the landed nobles had been mortgaged to the state and noble banks. The economic argument for emancipation was becoming irrefutable, and many landowners were shifting willy-nilly to the free labour system by contracting other people's serfs. Since the peasants' redemption payments would cancel out the gentry's debts, the economic rationale was becoming irresistible. In 1858, the Tsar appointed a special commission to formulate proposals for the emancipation in consultation with provincial gentry committees. Under pressure from die-hard squires to limit the reform or to fix the rules for the land transfers in their favour, the commission became bogged down in political wrangling for the best part of 2 years. In the end, the reactionary gentry were defeated, and the moderate reformists got their way, thanks in no small measure to the personal intervention of the Tsar. The Edict of Emancipation was signed by Alexander on the 19th of February 1861 and read to the peasants by their parish priests. It was not as far-reaching as the peasantry had expected. The edict allowed the landowners considerable leeway in choosing the bits of land for transfer to the peasantry and in setting the redemption dues the peasant communes would have to pay for them, whereas the peasants had expected to be given all the land without payment. There were rebellions in many areas, sometimes after rumours circulated that the published law was not the one the Tsar had meant to sign, but a forgery by nobles and officials who wanted to prevent the real emancipation, the long-awaited Golden Manifesto, in which the Tsar would liberate the peasants and give them all the land. Despite the disappointment of the peasantry, the emancipation was a crucial watershed. Freedom of a sort, however limited it may have been in practice, had at last been granted to the mass of the people, and there were grounds to hope for a national rebirth. Writers compared the edict to the conversion of Russia to Christianity in the 10th century. They spoke about the need for young Russia to liberate itself from the sins of its past, whose riches had been purchased by the people's sweat and blood, about the need for the landlord and the peasant to overcome their old divisions and become reconciled by nationality. For, as Fyodor Dostoevsky wrote in 1861, every Russian is a Russian first of all. Along with the emancipation of the serfs, the defeat in the Crimean War accelerated the Tsar's plans for a reform of the army. Tolstoy was not the only officer to advance proposals for reform during the Crimean War. In the summer of 1855, Count Fyodor Rydiger, commander of the Guards and Grenadiers, endorsed many of Tolstoy's criticisms of the officer corps in a memorandum to the Tsar. Blaming Russia's imminent defeat on the gross incompetence of the senior command and the army's administration, Rydiger advised that officers should be trained in military science rather than in parades and reviews, and that those with talent should be given wider scope to take responsibility on the battlefield. Shortly afterwards, similar ideas were put forward by another high-ranking member of the military establishment, Adjutant General V.A. Glinka, who also criticised the army's system of supply. Proposals were advanced for the building of railways, the lack of which, it was agreed by everyone, had been a major reason for the supply problems of the military during the Crimean War. The Tsar set up a commission for the improvement of the military sphere under General Rydiger, but then began to waver over implementing its proposed reforms, with which he clearly sympathised. Although plans for a network of railways to link Moscow and St. Petersburg with the major centres of agriculture and the border areas were approved by the Tsar as early as January 1857. Alexander was afraid of a possible reaction by the aristocracy at a time when he needed its support for the emancipation of the serfs. He put in charge of the war ministry a man well known for his loyalty and military incompetence, General Nikolai Sukhozanet, who oversaw a period of tinkering reforms, mostly minor statutes, altering the appearance of the guards' uniforms, but including two initiatives that were to have more significance. A revision of the military criminal statute to reduce the maximum number of lashes permissible as corporal punishment from 6,000 to 1,500, a figure still quite adequate to kill any soldier, and measures to improve the education and military training of the peasant soldiers, who were nearly all illiterate and unfit for modern war, as the Crimean War had clearly shown. One of the results of these attempts to improve the army's education was the creation of a new journal, Voyenny Zbornik, Military Miscellany. Its aim was to appeal to officers and soldiers by presenting them with lively articles about military science and affairs, stories, poems, and articles about society written in a liberal spirit of reform. Exempted from military censorship, it was similar in conception to the Military Gazette, which Tolstoy had proposed in 1854. Its literary section was edited by Nikolai Chernyshevsky, editor of the hugely influential democratic journal The Contemporary, in which Tolstoy's own works had appeared. Chernyshevsky was himself the author of the novel What Is to Be Done, 1862, which would inspire several generations of revolutionaries, including Lenin. By the 1860s, Voyenny Zbornik was rivaling the sales of The Contemporary, with more than 5,000 subscribers, demonstrating that ideas of reform had a receptive audience in the Russian army after the Crimean War. The idea of setting up Voyenny Zbornik had come from Dmitry Milyutin, the main driving force behind the military reforms after the Crimean War. A professor at the military academy, where he had taught since being gravely wounded in the campaign against Chamil in the Caucasus in 1838, Milyutin was a brilliant military analyst who quickly took on board the lessons of the defeat in the Crimea, the need to reform and modernize the military on the model of the Western forces that had so roundly beaten Russia's backward serf army. He soon had a chance to apply these lessons to the Tsar's ongoing struggles in the Caucasus. In 1856, the Tsar had appointed his longtime confidant, Prince A.I. Baryatinsky, as viceroy of the Caucasus, with extraordinary powers to finish off the war against Chamil. Baryatinsky was an advocate of expanding Russia's influence in the Caucasus and Central Asia as an antidote to the curtailment of her influence in Europe after the Crimean War. Alexander was persuaded by his arguments. Even before the Paris Treaty was announced, the Tsar announced his intention to step up the campaign against the Muslim rebels in the Caucasus. He exempted units in the Caucasus from the general military demobilization, mobilized new regiments, and ordered a consignment of 10,000 Minier rifles, purchased from abroad, to be sent to Baryatinsky, who, by the end of 1857, had overall control of more than one-sixth of the military budget and 300,000 men. Baryatinsky brought in Milyutin as his chief of staff to introduce the military reforms which he saw were needed in the Caucasus. If they were successful there, they would reinforce the arguments for the reform of the Russian army as a whole. Drawing on Western military thinking, as well as the proposals of General Friediger, Milyutin proposed to rationalize the chain of command, giving more initiative and control of resources to local commanders to exercise their judgment in response to the local conditions, an idea predicated on a general improvement in the training of officers. The end of the Crimean War had left Chamil's movement completely demoralized. Without the intervention of the Western powers and little real assistance from the Ottomans, the guerrilla movement of the Muslim tribes came to the end of its ability to continue fighting the Russians. The Chechens were exhausted by the war, which had lasted 40 years, and delegations from all over Chechnya were appealing to Chamil to make peace with the Russians. Chamil wanted to fight on, but against the massive surge of military forces deployed by Baryatinsky, he was unable to hold out for long, and he finally surrendered to the Russians on the 25th of August, 1859. On the basis of the army's triumph in the Caucasus, in November 1861, Milyutin was appointed Minister of War on Baryatinsky's recommendation to the Tsar. Once the Edict of Emancipation had been passed, Alexander felt the time had at last come to push through the military reforms. The legislative package presented by Milyutin to the Tsar built upon his earlier plans. The most important piece of legislation, passed only in 1874, was the introduction of universal conscription, with military service declared compulsory for all males at the age of 20. Organized through a territorial system of military districts for the maintenance of a peacetime standing army, the new Russian system was similar to the modern conscript armies of other European states, although in Tsarist Russia, where government finances were inadequate and class, religious and ethnic hierarchies continued to be felt in the application of every policy, the universal principle was never fully realized. The main emphasis of Milyutin's legislation was on military efficiency, but humanitarian concerns were never far behind in his reform. His fundamental mission was to reshape the army's culture so that it related to the peasant soldier as a citizen and no longer as a serf. The army schools were modernized, with greater emphasis on the teaching of military science and technology. Elementary schooling was made compulsory for all recruits, so that the army became an important means of education for the peasantry. The military justice system was reformed and corporal punishment was abolished, in theory at least, for in practice the Russian soldier continued to be punished physically and sometimes even flogged for relatively minor infringements of discipline. the army's culture of serfdom continued to be felt by the common soldier until 1917. The Crimean War reinforced in Russia a long-felt sense of resentment against Europe. There was a feeling of betrayal that the West had sided with the Turks against Russia. It was the first time in history that a European alliance had fought on the side of a Muslim power against another Christian state in a major war. No one resented Europe more than Dostoevsky. At the time of the Crimean War, he was serving as a soldier in the fortress of Semipalatinsk in Central Asia, following his release from a Siberian prison camp, to which he had been exiled for his involvement in the left-wing Petroshevsky circle in 1849. In the only published verse he ever wrote, and the poetic qualities of On the European Events of 1854 are such that one can see why this was so, Dostoevsky portrayed the Crimean War as the crucifixion of the Russian Christ. But, as he warned the Western readers of his poem, Russia would arise, and, when she did so, she would turn towards the East in her providential mission to Christianize the world. Unclear to you is her predestination. The East is hers. To her a million generations untiringly stretch out their hands, and the resurrection of the ancient East by Russia, so God has commanded, is drawing near. Having been defeated by the West, Russia turned towards Asia in its imperial plans. For Baryatinsky and the War Ministry, the defeat of Shamil in the Caucasus was to serve as a springboard for the Russian conquest of the independent Khanates of Central Asia. Gorchakov and the Foreign Ministry were not so sure, fearing that an expansionist policy would set back their attempts to mend relations with the British and the French. Caught at first between these opposing policies, in 1856-7, the Tsar moved towards the view that Russia's destiny lay in Asia, and that only Britain stood in the way of its fulfilment. Deeply influenced by the climate of mutual suspicion between Russia and Britain after the Crimean War, it was a viewpoint that would define Russia's policies in the Great Game, its imperial rivalry with Britain for supremacy in Central Asia. The Tsar was concerned by the growing presence of the British in Persia following their victory in the Anglo-Persian War of 1856-7. By the Paris Treaty of March 1857, the Persians withdrew from Herat, the northwestern Afghan city they had occupied with Russian backing in 1852 and 1856. From his correspondence with Baryatinsky, it is clear that Alexander was afraid that the British would use their influence in Tehran to install themselves on the southern shores of the Caspian. He shared Baryatinsky's gloomy prediction that the appearance of the British flag on the Caspian would be a fatal blow not only to our influence in the East, not only to our foreign trade, but also to the political independence of the Russian Empire. Alexander commissioned a report from Sukhozanet on the possibility of an armed clash between Russia and England in Central Asia. Although the report rejected the idea of a British military threat, the Tsar persisted in his fear that the British might deploy their Indian army to conquer Central Asia and expel the Russians from the Caucasus. In the spring of 1857, the British steamer Kangaroo and several smaller vessels carrying military supplies for Shamil's forces had been caught on the Circassian coast. Russia no longer had a Black Sea fleet to block such acts of intervention into its affairs by the British. Alexander demanded categorical explanations from the British government, but received none. The unmentionable infamy, as he called the Kangaroo affair, reinforced the Tsar's belief that Russia would not be secure against the British threat as long as the Caucasus remained unconquered and the Central Asian steppe beyond her political control. Throughout the Crimean War, the Russians had considered various ideas for an attack through Central Asia towards Kandahar and India, mainly as a means of diverting British troops from the Crimea. Although these plans were all rejected as impracticable, rumours of a Russian invasion were widely circulated and believed in India, where inflammatory pamphlets called on Muslims and Hindus to take advantage of the exhaustion of the British in the Crimea to rise up against their rule. The outbreak of the Indian Mutiny in the early summer of 1857 encouraged the Tsar to reconsider his Central Asia plans. The Royal Navy could threaten Russia's coastline in the Baltic, in the Pacific Ocean, and in the Black Sea, which was now defenceless as a result of the demilitarization imposed on the Russians by the Paris Treaty. The only place where the Russians could even pretend to mount a counter-threat was in India. The British were extremely sensitive to any threat against their Indian Empire, mainly because of their fragile tax base there, which they dared not increase for political reasons. Few Russian strategists believed in the reality of a campaign against India, but exploiting British nervousness was good tactics. In the autumn of 1857, the Tsar commissioned a strategic memorandum on Central Asia by a brilliant young military attaché, Nikolai Ignatieff, who had been brought to his attention after he had represented Russia on the question of its disputed border with Moldavia at the Paris Congress. Considering the possibility of a renewed war against Britain, Ignatieff argued that the only place where Russia stood a chance of victory was in Asia. Russia's strength in Central Asia was the best guarantee of peace, so Russia should exploit the Indian crisis to strengthen its position at the expense of Britain in the countries which separate Russia from the British possessions. Ignatieff proposed sending expeditions to explore and map the undiscovered steppe of Central Asia for the benefit of Russian trade and military intelligence. By developing commercial and diplomatic ties with the Khanates of Kokand, Bukhara, and Khiva, Russia could turn them into buffer states against British expansion. Giving his approval to the plan, the Tsar sent an exploratory party to Khiva and Bukhara under the leadership of Ignatieff, which concluded economic treaties with the two Khanates in the summer of 1858. Officially, the mission had been sent by the Foreign Ministry, but unofficially, it was also working for the War Ministry, collecting topographical, statistical, and general military information on various routes into Central Asia. From the start of the Russian initiative, there was a more forward policy favoured by the followers of Bariatinsky in the War Ministry to set up protectorates and military bases in the Khanates for the conquest of Turkestan and the Central Asian steppe, right up to the borders of Afghanistan. The Russian advance into Central Asia was led by two veterans of the Crimean War. One was Mikhail Chernaev, who had fought against the Turks on the Danube in 1853 and had distinguished himself for his bravery at Inkerman and Sevastopol before being transferred to defend Russian colonists against the raids of the Central Asian tribes on the steppes of southern Orenburg. From 1851, Chernaev began launching his own raids deep into the territory of Turkestan, destroying Kyrgyz and other hostile tribal settlements and supporting rebellions against the Khanates of Khiva and Kokand by other Central Asian tribes who were willing to declare their allegiance to Russia. Chernaev's military initiatives, quietly supported but not endorsed officially by the War Ministry, led by stealth to the Russian annexation of Turkestan. In 1864, Chernaev led a force of 1,000 men across the steppes of Turkestan to occupy the fortress of Chimkent. Joined by a second Russian column from Semipalatinsk, they then seized Tashkent, 130 kilometres to the south, effectively imposing Russian rule on this vital power base of the Central Asian cotton trade. Chernaev was awarded the St. George Cross and appointed military governor of Turkestan in 1865. After angry diplomatic protests by the British, who were afraid that the Russian troops might continue their advance from Tashkent to India, the Russian government disowned responsibility for the invasion carried out by Chernaev. The general was forced into retirement in 1866, but unofficially he was received as a hero in Russia. The nationalist press proclaimed him the Yermak of the 19th century. Meanwhile, the conquest of the Central Asian steppe was carried on by General Kaufmann, a second veteran of the Crimean War, who had led the sappers at the Siege of Kars before becoming Milyutin's chief of engineers at the War Ministry. Kaufmann replaced Chernaev as the military governor of Turkestan. In 1868, he completed the conquest of Samarkand and Bukhara. 5 years later, Kiva also fell to the Russians, followed by Kokand in 1876. Left in the hands of their respective khans as far as their internal government was concerned, but subject to the control of the Russians in their foreign relations, Bukhara and Kiva became essentially protectorates along the line of the princely states of British India. Chernaev and Ignatiev became leading figures in the Pan-Slav movement of the 1860s and 1870s. Along with Russia's turn towards the east, Pan-Slavism was the other main reaction by the Russians to their defeat in the Crimean War, as their feelings of resentment against Europe led to an explosion of nationalist sentiment. With censorship relaxed by the liberal reforms of the new Tsar, a new slew of Pan-Slav journals forcefully criticized Russia's foreign policy before the Crimean War. In particular, they attacked the legitimist policies of Nicholas I for having sacrificed the Balkan Christians to Muslim rule in the interests of the concert of Europe. "For the sake of the balance of Europe," Pogodin wrote in the first number of the Pan-Slav journal Paris in January 1859, 10 million Slavs are forced to groan, suffer, and agonize under the yoke of the most savage despotism, the most unbridled fanaticism, and the most desperate ignorance." With Gorchakov's abandonment of these legitimist principles, the Pan-Slavs renewed their calls on the government to support the liberation of the Balkan Slavs from Turkish rule. Some went so far as to claim that Russia should protect itself against a hostile West by uniting all the Slavs of Europe under Russian leadership, an idea first put forward by Pogodin during the Crimean War, and repeated with even more insistence in his writings afterwards. As Pan-Slav ideas gained influence in Russian intellectual and government circles, there was a proliferation of philanthropic organizations to promote the Pan-Slav cause by sending money to the Balkan Slavs for schools and churches, or by bringing students to Russia. The Moscow Slavic Benevolent Committee was established in 1858, with separate branches opening in St. Petersburg and Kiev in the 1860s. Funded by private benefactors and the Ministry of Education, it brought together officials and military men, many of them veterans of the Crimean War who had fought in the Balkans, with academics and writers, including Dostoevsky and Chuchev, who both belonged to the St. Petersburg Committee. During the first post-war years, the Pan-Slavs were cautious not to discuss openly their more radical ideas of Slavic political unification, nor to criticize too severely the foreign policy of the government. The views expressed by Pogodin led to Paris being banned. But by the early 1860s, when Ignatiev emerged as a Pan-Slav supporter and became a leading figure in the government, they became more vocal in their views. Ignatiev's growing influence in foreign affairs was based largely on his highly successful negotiation of the Sino-Russian Treaty of Beijing in November 1860, which gave Russia possession of the Amur and Ussuri regions, as well as Vladivostok in the Far East. In 1861, Ignatiev became director of the Asiatic Department of the Foreign Ministry, the office responsible for Russia's policy in the Balkans. 3 years later, he was appointed as the Tsar's envoy to Constantinople, a post he held until the Russo-Turkish War of 1877-8. Throughout these years, Ignatiev pushed for a military solution to the Eastern question in the Balkans, Russian-sponsored Slav uprisings against Turkish rule, and the intervention of the Tsarist army, leading to the liberation of the Slavs and the creation of a Slavic Union under Russian leadership. Pan-Slav ambitions for the Balkans focused first on Serbia, where the restoration of the Europeanized but autocratic Prince Mihailo to the throne in 1860 was seen as a victory for Russian influence and yet another defeat for the Austrians. Gorchakov supported the Serb movement for liberation from the Turks, fearing otherwise that if they gained independence on their own, the Serbs would fall under Austrian or Western influence. Writing to the Russian consul in Bucharest, the foreign minister underlined that our policy in the East is directed mainly towards strengthening Serbia materially and morally, and giving her the opportunity to stand at the head of the movement in the Balkans. Ignatieff went further, advocating an immediate solution to the Eastern question by military means. Taking up a proposal by Mikhailo, he urged the Russian government to support the Serbs in a war against the Turks and help them form a confederation with the Bulgarians, to which Bosnia, Herzegovina and Montenegro could be joined. Under Pan-Slav pressure, the Russian Foreign Ministry increased its support for the Serb movement. After a Turkish bombardment of Belgrade in 1862, the Russians called a special conference of the signatories of the Paris Treaty at Kanlidze near Constantinople, and eventually succeeded in getting the removal of the final Turkish garrisons from Serbia in 1867. It was their first major diplomatic victory since the end of the Crimean War. Encouraged by their success, the Russians gave their backing to the Serbian attempt to create a Balkan League. Serbia formed a military alliance with Montenegro and Greece and a pact of friendship with the Romanian leadership and established closer ties with Croatian and Bulgarian nationalists. The Russians subsidized the Serb army, though a mission sent by Milutin to inspect it found it in a chronic state. Then, in the autumn of 1867, Prince Mikhailo backed away from war against the Turks, prompting Russia to suspend its war credits. The assassination of Mikhailo the following June confirmed the end of Russian-Serb cooperation and the collapse of the Balkan League. The next 7 years were a period of relative calm in the Balkans. The imperial monarchies of Russia, Austria-Hungary and Germany, the Three Emperors League of 1873, guaranteed the preservation of the status quo in the Balkans. Official Russian policy in these years was based on a firm commitment to the European balance of power, and on that basis, Gorchakov secured a major diplomatic victory with the annulment of the Paris Treaty's Black Sea clauses at a conference of the European powers in London in 1871. But unofficially, the policy of Russia remained the encouragement of the Pan-Slav movement in the Balkans, a policy coordinated by Ignatieff from the Russian embassy in Constantinople through its consulates in the Balkan capitals. In his memoirs, written at the end of his long life in the 1900s, Ignatieff explained that his aim in the Balkans in the 1860s and 1870s had been to destroy the Treaty of Paris, to recover southern Bessarabia, and to control the Turkish Straits, either directly through military conquest or indirectly through a treaty with a dependent Turkey of the kind Russia had enjoyed before the Crimean War. "All my activities in Turkey and among the Slavs," he wrote, "were inspired by the view that Russia alone could rule in the Balkan Peninsula and Black Sea. Austria-Hungary's expansion would be halted, and the Balkan peoples, especially the Slavs, would direct their gaze exclusively to Russia and make their future dependent on her." In the summer of 1875, revolts by Christians against Turkish rule in Herzegovina spread north into Bosnia and then into Montenegro and Bulgaria. The revolts had been sparked by a sharp increase in taxes levied by the Turkish government on the Christian peasants after harvest failures had left the port in a financial crisis. But they soon took on the character of a religious war. The leaders of the uprisings looked to Serbia and Russia for support. Encouraged by Ignatieff, Serbian nationalists in Belgrade called on their government to send in troops to defend the Slavs against the Turks and unite them in a greater Serbia. In Bulgaria, the rebels were badly armed and organized, but their hatred of the Turks was intense. In the spring of 1876, the revolt spilled over into massacres against the Muslim population, which had increased massively since the Crimean War as a result of the immigration of about 500,000 Crimean Tatars and Circassians fleeing from the Russians to Bulgaria. Tensions with the Christians were intensified when the newcomers reverted to a semi-nomadic way of life, launching raids on the Christian settlements and stealing livestock in a way not experienced before by the peasants in the area. Lacking enough regular troops to quell the Bulgarians, the Ottoman authorities used the Bashi Bazouks, irregulars mostly drawn from the local Muslim population, who brutally suppressed their Christian neighbours, massacring around 12,000 people in the process. In the mountain village of Batak, where 1,000 Christians had taken refuge in a church, the Bashi Bazouks set fire to the building, burning to death all but one old woman who survived to tell the tale. News of the Bulgarian atrocities spread throughout the world. The British press claimed that tens of thousands of defenceless Christian villagers had been slaughtered by fanatical Muslims. British attitudes to Turkey changed dramatically. The old policy of promoting the Tanzimat reforms in the belief that the Turks were willing pupils of English liberal governance was seriously questioned and, for many Christians, completely undermined by the Bulgarian massacres. Gladstone, the leader of the liberal opposition, whose views on foreign policy were closely linked to his High Church Anglican moral principles, took the lead in a popular campaign for British intervention to protect the Balkan Christians against Turkish violence. Gladstone had only cautiously supported the Crimean War. He was hostile to the presence of the Turks in Europe on religious grounds and had long wanted to use British influence to secure more autonomy for the Christians in the Ottoman Empire. In 1856, he had even advanced the idea of a new Greek empire in the Balkans to protect the Christians, not just against the Muslims of Turkey, but against the Russians and the Pope. The strongest reaction to the Bulgarian atrocities was in Russia. Sympathy for the Bulgarians engulfed the whole of educated society in a surge of patriotic feeling, intensified by a national desire for revenge against the Turks after the Crimean War. Calls for intervention to protect the Bulgarians were heard from all quarters, from Slavophiles such as Dostoevsky, who saw in a war for the liberation of the Balkan Slavs the fulfilment of Russia's historical destiny to unite the Orthodox, and from Westernizers such as Turgenev, who thought it was the duty of the liberal world to liberate enslaved Bulgaria. Here was a golden opportunity for the Pan-Slavs to realize their dreams. Officially, the Russian government denounced the Christian revolts in the Balkans. It was on the defensive, having been accused by Western governments of instigating the revolts. But Pan-Slav opinion, and in particular the journal Ruski Mir, Russian World, owned and edited by Chernayev, the former military governor of Turkestan, came out in support of the Balkan Christian cause and called on the government to support it. "Speak but one word, Russia," Ruski Mir predicted, "and not only the entire Balkans, but all the Slav peoples will rise in arms against their oppressors. In alliance with her 25 million fellow Orthodox, Russia will strike fear into all of Western Europe." Everything depended on the actions of Serbia, the Piedmont of the Balkans, in the phrase of Chernayev. The Tsar and Gorchakov warned the Serbian leaders not to intervene in the uprisings, though privately they sympathized with the Pan-Slavs. "Do anything you like, provided we do not know anything about it officially," Baron Zhomini, the acting head of the Russian Foreign Ministry, told a member of the St. Petersburg Committee. Encouraged by Ignatiev and the Russian consul in Belgrade, as well as by the arrival of Chernayev as a volunteer for the Slav cause in April, the Serb leaders declared war on Turkey in June 1876. The Serbs were counting on the armed intervention of Russia. Chernayev was in charge of their main army. Along with his presence, Ignatieff's promises had led them to believe that this would be a repetition of the Balkan War of 1853-4, when Nicholas I had sent his army into the Danubian principalities in the expectation, ultimately disappointed, that it would encourage a war of liberation by the Slavs. Public opinion in Russia was increasingly belligerent. The nationalist press called on the army to defend the Christians against the Turks. Pan-Slav groups sent volunteers to fight on their behalf, and about 5,000 made their way to Serbia. Subscriptions were organized to send money to the Slavs. Pro-Slav feelings swept across society. People talked about the war as a crusade, a repeat of the war against the Turks in 1854. By the autumn of 1876, war fever had spread to the Russian court and government circles. Chernyev's army faced defeat. Responding to his desperate pleas for help, the Tsar sent an ultimatum to the Porte and mobilized his troops. This was enough to force the Turks to end hostilities against the Serbs, who duly made their peace with them. Abandoning the Serbs, the Russians shifted their support to the Bulgarians and demanded autonomy for them, which the Turks would not accept. With Austria's neutrality assured through promises of gains in Bosnia and Herzegovina, in April 1877, Russia declared war on Turkey once again. From the start, the Russian offensive in the Balkans assumed the character of a religious war. It was overwhelmingly redolent of the opening Russo-Turkish phase of the Crimean War. As the Russians crossed the Danube under the command of the Grand Duke Nikolai, they were joined by Slav irregulars, Bulgarians and Serbs, some of them demanding money to fight, but most fighting for their national cause against the Turks. This was the sort of Christian war that Nicholas had wanted when his troops had crossed the Danube in 1853-4. Encouraged by the rising of the Slavs, Alexander considered pushing on to seize Constantinople and impose a Russian settlement on the Balkans. He was urged to do so not only by the Pan-Slav press, but by his own brother, the Grand Duke Nikolai, who wrote to him after his armies had captured Adrianople, a short march from Constantinople, in January 1878. "We must go to the centre, to Tsargrad, and there finish the holy cause you have assumed." Pan-Slav hopes were at their height. "Constantinople must be ours," wrote Dostoevsky, who saw its conquest by the Russian armies as nothing less than God's own resolution of the Eastern question and as the fulfillment of Russia's destiny to liberate Orthodox Christianity. "It is not only the magnificent port, not only the access to the seas and oceans that binds Russia so closely to the resolution of this fateful question, nor is it even the unification and regeneration of the Slavs. Our goal is more profound, immeasurably more profound. We, Russia, are truly essential and unavoidable, both for the whole of Eastern Christendom and for the whole fate of future Orthodoxy on the earth, for its unity. This is what our people and their rulers have always understood. In short, this terrible Eastern question is virtually our entire fate for years to come. It contains, as it were, all our goals and, mainly, our only way to move out into the fullness of history." Alarmed by the advance of the Russian troops to Adrianople, the British ordered their Mediterranean fleet to enter the Dardanelles and agreed in Parliament to raise £6 million for military purposes. It was a repeat of the movements that had led to the Crimean War. Under pressure from the British, the Russians agreed to an armistice with the Ottomans, but continued advancing towards Constantinople, halting only under threat from the Royal Navy at San Stefano, a village just outside the Turkish capital, where, on the 3rd of March, they signed a treaty with the Turks. By the Treaty of San Stefano, the Porte agreed to recognise the full independence of Romania, Serbia and Montenegro, as well as the autonomy of a large Bulgarian state, to include Macedonia and part of Thrace. In exchange for a narrow strip of land to the south of the Danube, Romania ceded back to Russia southern Bessarabia, the territory taken from the Russians by the Treaty of Paris. With the restoration of her Black Sea status completed 7 years before, Russia had succeeded in reversing all the losses she had suffered after the Crimean War. The Treaty of San Stefano was mainly Ignatieff's doing. It was the realization of most of his Pan-Slav dreams, but it was totally unacceptable to the Western powers, which had not gone to war to stop the Russians bullying the Turks in 1854, only to allow them to do so again 24 years afterwards. In Britain, the old warlike feelings against Russia were expressed in jingoism, a new aggressive mood of can-do foreign policy summed up by the current hit song of pubs and music halls. "We don't want to fight, but by jingo if we do. We've got the ships, we've got the men, we've got the money too. We've fought the bear before, and while we're Britons true, the Russians shall not have Constantinople." Afraid of British intervention and a possible repeat of the Crimean War, the Tsar ordered the Grand Duke to withdraw his troops to the Danube. As they did so, they took part in revenge attacks against the Muslims of Bulgaria, which were joined and sometimes instigated by Christian volunteers. Several hundred thousand Muslims fled Bulgaria for the Ottoman Empire at the end of the Russo-Turkish War. Determined to halt the extension of Russian power into the Balkans, the great powers met at the Congress of Berlin to revise the Treaty of San Stefano. The main objection of the British and the French was the establishment of a Greater Bulgaria, which they viewed as a Russian Trojan horse threatening the Ottoman Empire in Europe. With direct access to the Aegean Sea and Macedonia, this enlarged Bulgarian state could easily be used by the Russians to attack the Turkish Straits. The British forced the Russians to agree to the division of Bulgaria, returning Macedonia and Thrace to direct Ottoman control. A week before the Berlin Congress, Benjamin Disraeli, the British Prime Minister, had concluded a secret alliance with the Ottomans against Russia, whereby Britain was allowed to occupy the strategic island of Cyprus and bring in troops from India. The revelation of this alliance, along with Disraeli's threats of war, forced the Russians to concede to his demands. The Congress of Berlin ended Russia's Pan-Slav hopes. Ignatieff was dismissed as the Tsar's envoy to Constantinople and went into retirement. Arriving back in London to a hero's welcome, Disraeli claimed that he had brought back peace with honour from Berlin. He told the House of Commons that the Treaty of Berlin and the Cyprus Convention would protect Britain and its route to India against Russian aggression for years to come. But tensions in the Balkans would remain. In many ways, the Congress sowed the seeds of the future Balkan Wars and the First World War by leaving so many border disputes unresolved. Above all, the fundamental problem of the Eastern Question, the sick man of Europe, Turkey, remained without a cure. As the British Foreign Secretary, the Marquis of Salisbury, acknowledged on his return from Berlin, "We shall set up a rickety sort of Turkish rule south of the Balkans once again, but it is a mere respite. There is no vitality left in it." In Jerusalem, where all these international conflicts had begun, the end of the Crimean War was proclaimed on the 14th of April 1856. A salute from the castle guns announced that the Pasha had been informed of the peace, and his troops assembled on the public square outside the Jaffa Gate for Thanksgiving prayers led by the Imam. It was to the same square that they had been summoned in September 1853 to go and fight for their Sultan against Russia. History had come full circle in Jerusalem. 12 days later, on the 26th of April, the old religious rivalries began once again. Fights broke out between the Greeks and the Armenians during the ceremony of the Holy Fire in the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. For several days before the sacred ceremony, rival groups of pilgrims had smuggled various weapons into the church and concealed them there. Others were supplied with knives and iron spikes thrown from a window near the roof of the St. Nicholas Convent. It was not clear how the fighting started, the British consul, Finn, who witnessed it, reported 3 days afterwards, but during the conflict, the missiles were also flung upwards to the galleries, demolishing rows of lamps and tearing church pictures representing the most sacred subjects of faith, glass and oil pouring down upon their heads, and silver lamps on silver chains were beaten down, and the materials have since vanished. The Pasha left his place in the gallery and ordered up his guard to separate the fighters, but he was badly hurt by a blow to his head and had to be carried away on his men's shoulders, the crowd in the church being too thick to allow a passage otherwise, while his secretary was also beaten up. Eventually, a squadron of the Pasha's soldiers rounded up the rioters, the church attendants cleared up all the mess, and the ceremony of the Holy Fire proceeded as usual. The monks standing guard before the tomb of Christ, the congregation chanting, "Lord, have mercy," a until the patriarch emerged bearing lighted candles, and, as the church bells rang, the pilgrims pressed towards him to light their torches from the miraculous flames.